This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
I had a very low opinion of Volodymyr Zelensky. I liked him as a comedian. He fumbled the relationship with Trump. I did not think he was leading the country well. 2 weeks after the Russians had started actually hitting, so all the lights were off in the presidential palace. So they took me around back. I know the guy, but it was like I was with a completely different person. I felt like I was like with Lech Walesa or Mandela or Charles de Gaulle, but like in my lifetime.
Jared Cohen has had some of the coolest job titles in the world. One of Time magazine's 100 most influential people, a former advisor to Hillary Clinton, specializing in counterterrorism.
The 9/11 hijackers were radicalized by watching far less content.
Director of ideas at Google.
I just like woke up one day at Google.
President of global affairs at Goldman Sachs.
When you've achieved everything that you're going to achieve in your life, how on earth do you top that and figure out what to do next?
He's just written a book on what presidents do after leaving office.
Is it a good idea to have half a dozen men had been elevated to the presidency kind of like wandering around us?
It's an amazing read about what you can do with your life after doing the biggest job in the world.
There was only one whose popularity had doubled.
He covers serious topics too.
The greatest leaders in history have often emerged out of a crisis. You're going to have only the second rematch between two presidents in American history. If we think we have a hard time figuring out what to do with ex-presidents in the US, I think it's even harder to figure out what to do with ex-prime ministers.
Well, I was so inspired by Jared's question about what UK prime ministers do after leaving office that I wrote about it in this week's City AM notebook column. The episode is kindly powered by City AM, London's most read financial and business newspaper. I've included a link to the City AM piece in the show notes below, or you can download the City AM app and read it there. Now, on to the show.
So you get serious postpartum depression after you finish a book. It's like it's a real problem, right? You dedicate anywhere from, 3 to 5 years sometimes writing these history books, and then it's done, yeah. And you feel this kind of emptiness, right? So you have, the way you satisfy that emptiness is you have to have another baby,
yeah.
Right? And the author equivalent of making love to have another baby is selling another book,
yeah.
Right? And so that's, so I wanted to make love again, and so I sold another book, and I figured I had just written a book about what happens when the president dies in office. What happens if they survive the office? That's sort of the kitschy answer. The honest answer to this question is, my dad is a psychologist, my grandfather was a psychologist, my aunts and uncles are psychologists. I've always had this fascination with behavioral psychology, but then I've always been tortured, like I think any young person is, with this just obsession with what do you do next?
Yeah.
Right? You sacrifice the present in service of like obsessively worrying about what you do next. And, when you get to your next thing, you don't have time to reflect on, what you would have done differently last time. Could you have enjoyed it more? You're on to kind of what's next after. I got to Goldman Sachs. Then 3 days of being there, people were asking me, what do you think you'll do next? I said, look, let me lift the stock vest first, right? And so I've just been tortured by this question of what's next. And I was starting to get antsy at Google and Alphabet, right? I just sort of, my interests were shifting. I didn't feel like the platform was as consistent with where my interests were going, which we can kind of go back to. And I decided, I don't really learn anything looking at these sort of case studies of these CEOs who transition or these athletes who transition. I'm sort of fascinated by the presidency. Let me start there. It's the most dramatic transition in the world. And as I dug into these stories, what I found fascinating is these seemingly unrelatable people have a harder time topping what's next than anyone else, which actually makes them more relatable when you think about their transitions because they have more constraints and challenges. And I basically only found 7 presidents that I thought found a greater sense of purpose after leaving the White House than during their time in it. And the rest of them was kind of a sad story, which is sort of also kind of humbling in a way. If it was that hard for them, it's going to be really hard for the rest of us. The thing that they all had in common, to get to your question, each one of them developed a strong sense of principle about something. Now, some of them left office knowing what that was. Some of them meandered around, and that sense of principle sort of, it was something they accidentally stumbled upon. But once each of them had a, they each had a heightened awareness of something they were deeply principled about it, and they doubled down on it in the post-presidency, and that's what made them successful and purposeful.
Yeah, because one of the most sort of interesting stories is William Taft, right? And actually getting, he doesn't want to be president and ends up getting the job that he's always dreamed of, right? And but he also turns that down. I mean, it was this sort of fascinating kind of career history of his presidents.
So the Taft one is extremely relatable, not because he weighed 355 pounds, which I suppose is relatable to some people, but I'd like to say I've been hitting the gym and I don't feel relatable to that. But the part that I think is so relatable about William Howard Taft, he actually, as an adolescent, knew what he was principled about. He used to say, I love judges, I love courts, I love the judicial system. All he ever wanted was to be a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. And he turns it down three times before becoming president. As president, he appoints six people, a record in a single term, to the Supreme Court, including a chief justice. And his story is an extraordinary and relatable story for anybody who knew what they wanted to do or had an opportunity, and they had to pass it by because the timing wasn't right, the circumstances weren't right. So you think about like many different sets of circumstances. For somebody who's a parent, they may have an issue with one of their kids and they just can't accept the big job, and it's sort of painful to have to do so, but it's the right thing. Sometimes people turn down a job they really want because they can't move, or they need to make more money, or some other set of circumstances, right? It's a painful thing. But William Howard Taft, in his last 10 years of life, finally gets that dream job. He becomes Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. It's the happiest decade of his life. On his, in his last year of life, somebody asked him, what he enjoyed more, being president or being Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and he said, "I hardly remember I was ever president." And the reason I found the Taft chapter so inspiring is, again, I think so many people find themselves in the exact situation that he was in, which is having to defer a dream. And what William Howard Taft offers is a reminder that a dream deferred does not need to be a dream denied, and a dream deferred can still be a dream that's achieved. And his story represents, I think, an extraordinary case study in what that looks like.
And what surprised you most in undertaking the book about what presidents do post office?
Yeah, I thought I was writing a book about the last chapter of life, right? So, before we started, we were talking about your audience, and we talked a lot about, those 20 somethings, 30 somethings. It might be they're thinking about their first, their opening act out of school, or in your 30s or late 20s, it's kind of when you make that first transition, right? You're out of the gate really strong. And are you going to break away from the pack? Or are you going to have sort of a false start on your second act? Or do you, it's just for that age group, it's interesting. The stakes are actually lower, and yet they feel higher. Right. You have the luxury of being anxious. And that anxiety just kind of overwhelms you, and the stakes for everything seem high. Right. And by the way, when you're working at a young age, the stakes seem high, and they couldn't be less high. Right. You actually can screw a lot of things up when you're 20s and 30s, and recover many times over. The stakes are high when you're actually in your last act. Before you're properly retiring. So I thought that's the book that I was writing about, is when you've achieved everything that you're going to achieve in your life, how on earth do you top that and figure out what to do next? And that was the story for the presidents that I wrote about, right? There's nothing more prestigious than being president, but there are things that are more purposeful than being president, at least for the seven figures I wrote about. So the thing that surprised me is just how, as I delved into each of these case studies, Thomas Jefferson, John Quincy Adams, Grover Cleveland, William Howard Taft, Herbert Hoover, Jimmy Carter, and George W. Bush, how prescriptive I found their experiences for people asking the question, what's next, at any stage of life. In their 20s coming out of school, or their penultimate act, or their final act, or somebody like me, who's kind of mid-career or midlife, depending on how you want to describe it. And that was a real surprise to me. And it led to, honestly, one of the most introspective journeys that I've ever had in my life. And I made my own transition in the midst of writing this book. And I wonder sometimes, if I wasn't writing this book, would I have left being a CEO of an alphabet company and gone to Goldman Sachs? I don't know. I think it made me like emotionally available and sort of vulnerable enough to have the sort of the courage to leave something that felt really good that I could do in my sleep to take something that was in fact a much greater risk. And I'll tell you, this has been the most fulfilling professional chapter I've had in my career.
And why, talk to us why you sort of left Google to go to Goldman Sachs, because part of my theory, the side of it of careers and status, is that in the early noughties, people wanted to be investment bankers, and then in the 2010s, they wanted to be more in the technology companies. You've kind of done it the other way around.
Yeah, I've never cared about those trends. The way that I've always operated, and I never quite appreciated this until I was sitting in a bath. I actually, if you know who Adam Grant is, a behavioral psychologist, yeah. Adam, I convinced Adam to become my de facto free therapist for a while until I think I was getting on his nerves. But the best advice he ever gave me, because again, I was a worrier for a long time, and I was somebody who, I didn't want to believe I was somebody who kind of lived to work, but my behavior would suggest that, which is I'd wake up I'd wake up in the morning, and all I would do is think about work, and I wouldn't enjoy it in the present. I'd think about where it was going, and so his advice to me was, you need to create structured worry time. He's like, where do you feel relaxed? I said, I kind of like taking baths. And so I started taking an hour bath every single day, no matter where. I won't stay in a hotel room unless there's a bathtub. So I just started, I spent an hour in the bathtub every single day, and that is my dedicated worry time. And the reason for that is, and I swear I'm going to get to your question, but the reason for that is I actually added up just, by estimate, the minutes, hours, days, weeks, and months that I probably wasted being anxious, worried about things that don't matter, right? Yeah. We're not talking about like a terminally ill relative, like things that really don't matter. Like somebody yelled at you, somebody was mean to you, you were worried about a reorg, would like destabilize you for weeks. Yeah, I probably lost a year of my life. I'm 42 now. I'd be 41 if I didn't waste all that time. So I decided to winnow down my worry time to an hour in the bathtub every single day. And anyway, long story short, the way that I've always thought about my career is not about like what's everyone doing now, what's the new trend. I have a very simple formula, which is I view my career as I'm a manager of a portfolio of curiosities, and I have a deep, deep sense of what I'm curious about, and I know what my long positions are in that portfolio. At any given day, I'm highly conscious of what's missing in that portfolio, what I want to draw down, what I want to ramp up. And I've always loved I've always had a very long position on geopolitics. I've always had a long position on tech, and I've always had a growing position on how business and geopolitics clash with each other. I just think it's kind of interesting, and I've always loved founding new things in big institutions. So, as somebody who loves geopolitics, when I was coming out of school, the best place to do that was the State Department. And the reason I like big institutions is it's like fun to navigate them, and there's tons of, underutilized expertise, and I like extracting value from them, and I actually like bureaucracy busting. And if you can figure it all out, you're sitting on the biggest platform in the world to do what you want. While I was at the State Department, the world was coming online. We were adding another 5 billion people to the internet, and all of a sudden the State Department started to feel like a very small, shrinking platform, and tech started to feel like a really big platform. We were on this precipice of the entire world coming online and all the problems that I was dealing with at the State Department, the geopolitical problems, spilling over into an entirely new dimension of the world, cyberspace and the internet ecosystem. And a place like Google was the biggest platform to do that. And so I just like woke up one day at Google.
Yeah.
And I would say sometime around the beginning of COVID, I started to have that same feeling. The Google platform was starting to feel smaller, despite the fact that the market cap was going up. And the user base was growing. Why? Because the geopolitical center of gravity had shifted in the midst of COVID to a return of great power competition between the US and China. And what that meant was every single business in every sector and geography related to national security or not, like a soap and beauty company even, was getting caught in the crossfire of geopolitics and getting hit by the geopolitical equivalent of shrapnel. And the Google platform was a great one when the geopolitical nexus with business was a niche issue that largely touched the tech sector and I guess the energy sector as well.
Yeah.
And so as I was watching everything unfold, all the issues that I wanted to work on, they felt out of reach from where I was at Google. And so I started busying myself with other things. And I had this realization that the problem with my day job is it's getting in the way of all my part-time jobs. And that typically tells you that maybe it's time to think about something else. It was not a logical conclusion for me to go to Goldman Sachs, but in the three jobs that I've had, I've always had a CEO or a leader who I had intellectual synergy with, who saw the same trends that I did and wanted to create a job for me that didn't exist in what they believed was the biggest platform in the world. And David Solomon, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, he and I had been friends for 13 years, and he believed that Goldman Sachs, for this particular moment, as a client services business that touches every business you can imagine, in every sector you can imagine, is a global business and is at the center as a regulated entity of the global financial system. He had a very strong, and banks on both sides of the geopolitical tension, he had a belief that it's a massive platform. And if I came to Goldman, I would realize that. I never thought that I was somebody who liked client services because I didn't really understand what that term meant. But my entire career, I've focused on engaging with the smartest and most interesting people of influence and approaching it in a very simple way, which is, what are your biggest ambitions? Let's try to define them together. How can I help? And then I want to deliver for you. And it's just a great way to spend life.
Yeah.
Right? Just delivering for people. I don't care if that's like a friend from college or a president or prime minister or a CEO or a founder or an NGO. I don't care who it is. If they're smart, if they're interesting, if they're somebody that I think can exercise influence and good intention in the world, what are you trying to do? How can I help? And let me deliver that for you. Amazing way to spend life. And so my intellectual interests aligned with a platform that I didn't fully understand at a moment of tremendous introspection. And I woke up one day at Goldman Sachs and there I am.
And what is the job of president of global affairs at Goldman Sachs?
So look, you have these two mega trends, the most unstable geopolitics in more than two decades, probably longer, and the most significant technology invented since the internet with generative AI and just technology more broadly. And these two mega trends separately and together are turning every single business upside down and forcing them to reflexively understand and forecast geopolitics and forecast technological trends in a way that they never had to before. And they don't have a machinery for doing that. So that's kind of, think of that as like the geopolitical and technology advising part. People build businesses around, we give that away for free. So we stood up an institute, you know, as president of global affairs, I also run an institute that focuses on delivering those insights for clients. Mm-hmm. And we do it, you know, and by the way, in each of those areas, everybody's asking the same 12 questions, you know, plus or minus a few, right? And so my view is the way to respond, I have lots of expertise in these areas, but, you know, I take these questions, like what's going to happen with this supply chain or that supply chain, and then I mine the entire firm, Goldman Sachs, for all the different pieces of expertise that exist, whether it's in our commodities business, our trading business, our banking business, our sector business, our engineering org, I put it all together, and it forms a picture on a puzzle box. And then we're able to show up, you know, to our clients, not with my opinion, but with a firm-wide opinion that is truly differentiated and leverages the full breadth of what the firm knows. So important around geopolitics and generative AI, where no one person or no one part of any business has all the breadth of knowledge. So why do we do that? What's the commercial value in that? I think we understand the nature of a business like Goldman Sachs as it pertains to there's a mandate, there's an M&A mandate, or there's a fundraising mandate, or, you know, there's a trade, and there's a mandate, and we want to win that mandate and get that business and we want to serve the client well. We understand that. What I'm after is something different, which is if you show up with firm-wide expertise that is truly differentiated, with a client that also has expertise on the same issues, it leads to a very different conversation. And all of a sudden, it's not reflexive, how do you navigate this? It's okay, with all this geopolitical volatility, all this technological change, and the expertise that you have and we have, how do we actually generate a mandate that doesn't exist around this and do it together? That's a much more interesting, you know, I find that to be a very interesting way to do business. Two, I think it's, you know, extremely commercial in terms of the benefit both to the client and the firm. But I don't think of it as client services. I think of it as you're forging an intellectual partnership that has no transactional component to it. And in the process of doing that, you're arriving at a commercial opportunity that you both benefit from.
And what is the what are the 10 or 12 questions that everybody's asking?
Look, people want to know the direction of travel on U.S.-China tensions. They want to understand where that's going to create sustained unpredictability and volatility in the world, and where it's going to lead to certain pockets of predictability that will germinate. So I've written about how as U.S.-China tensions persist for the balance of the decade, it's going to give rise to a whole new category of geopolitical swing states.
Yeah.
These are countries that are led by leaders with a global agenda independent of Washington and Beijing. They have a differentiated part of the supply chain, a differentiated amount of flexible capital that they can deploy. They're attractive for nearshoring, offshoring, and friendshoring. This is India, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, et cetera. I would even, I would even put a country like, Germany in this category, where it is part of the EU. It's the most, it's the biggest economic powerhouse in the EU, but you also see Germany operating individually and even doing things that are a different position from the EU. And so, I spend a lot of time sort of thinking about, whether those countries represent more predictability. The war in the Middle East, the war in Europe, the 4+ supply chains that the U.S. has called out as geopolitically important, critical minerals and rare earths, which are necessary for everything from the energy transition to technology, pharmaceuticals, which impacts the healthcare sector, microelectronics. People are asking questions about, generative AI. What are the big inflection points? Who are the winners? What does this mean for great power competition? What are the things that we should be watching and on what time horizon? What does U.S.-China tensions sustaining mean for the reorientation of capital? How does technology that changes the way money and value moves around the world impact the international system? This debate about de-dollarization, what are the headwinds and what are the tailwinds? How real is it? I mean, it's the same. It's different versions of the same questions in every single. And what I'm after is not these questions of short term, like what's going to happen in this election or that election. I'm interested in these persistent questions that have no binary answer, right? So, so everyone talks about how this is the year of where 40% of the world goes to the polls.
Yes.
I'm only going to be interested in that in December.
Yeah.
When I can look back on the year of elections and ask the question, what did the year of elections teach us about what to look for in all future elections going forward?
And do you think we are entering a new Cold War with those swing states, geopolitical swing states?
No, I actually hate the Cold War analogy. I have a really quarrelsome, aggressive, agitated, warmongery, from an intellectual perspective, attitude towards comparing U.S.-China tensions to the Cold War. I think it actually has none of the same attributes. And I think it's a very dangerous analogy. And I know you're channeling the people who say it to be provocative. So I know you are not dangerous. Let me be very clear. Here's why I quarrel with it. One, people love analogies, right? And instead, they should be in the business of intellectual cocktail making, which is they should look at different things that have happened in history and piece them, put them together to form, a cocktail rather than look for a one-to-one analogy. And so how is this different? For one, the U.S. has never been in a situation where its most formidable adversary is also its second or third largest trading partner. Two, the economies are completely intertwined. Three, they're the two world's largest economies. That was not the case with the Soviet Union. Four, the rivalry doesn't have the same ideological dimension. The Chinese Communist Party does want to revise the international system, but it doesn't have the same communist ideology thesis that the Soviet Union had. Neither country is trying to destroy the other or their system because they're so economically intertwined. It doesn't have the proxy war component. The U.S. is still fighting proxy wars with Russia. It's not fighting proxy wars with China.
But there is an element of that swing state stuff, right?
Well, so but the swing state stuff is different. So even there, I think the analogy breaks down. So what you had during the Cold War was communist bloc countries, capitalist bloc countries, and then a non-aligned movement. These countries that I describe as geopolitical swing states, they're not non-aligned. It's quite the opposite. They're actually really leaning into this. They're multi-aligned, right? They're basically, they recognize that the US and China are in a totally unique historic situation where they're the two winners from hyperglobalization and they're both unhappy with the outcome. The US is unhappy with the outcome of hyperglobalization because they're heavily reliant on China for a high concentration of their supply chain. And there's really nothing they can do about that in the short and medium term. China wants to revise the international system, a position that it believes it should be able to embrace as one of the winners from hyperglobalization, but they're stuck in a world dominated by the dollar as the global reserve currency and the economic headwinds associated with overcoming that are insurmountable in the short and medium term. 50 years from now, who knows? And so the two countries, they're stuck competitively coexisting with each other, and neither side is going to win. And so it's all about gaining the upper hand, and neither side can gain the upper hand without relying on other countries. And so the other countries that economically have some autonomy and have some leadership vision have emerged as almost kind of like leaders of the global South, right? There's a hierarchy that's developed, and you're seeing them swing on an issue-by-issue basis. Look at India. India is the ultimate geopolitical swing state. They'll side with the U.S. as it pertains to their, you know, sort of border entanglements with China. Then they're happy to side with the U.S. on its, you know, tough posture on China. Yeah. As it pertains to their economic entanglements with China, only if it's convenient for them. And as it pertains to the U.S.'s larger China ambition in the South China Sea and Taiwan Strait, they'll maintain a posture of strategic ambiguity. Meanwhile, they'll, you know, be the world's largest democracy staying neutral on Russia's invasion of Ukraine, making it so the U.S. can't couch this as a great battle between democracy and autocracy. They increase trade 400% with Russia since the war started. They buy $12 crude, and then but they buy it in rupees that the Russians don't need, and then they turn around and sell it to the Europeans, creating a perception of reorientation of energy supply chains when in fact it's just a redistribution. And so these countries are being multi-aligned. They're not blocking together. You're not seeing them block together, right? The only countries that are actually blocking together are doing so in a marriage of geopolitical convenience. So like North Korea, Russia, and Iran have sort of formed an axis of destabilization.
Yes.
Right? But the geopolitical swing states are more affirmatively leaning into advantages. They're playing a good hand really well. The Iranians, the Russians, and the North Koreans are playing a weak hand.
Yeah.
And so it's not in the interest of these geopolitical swing states to kind of, you know, forge like a movement of geopolitical swing states the way there was. The irony of the non-aligned movement is, you know, the countries that were within it weren't non-aligned. They just didn't want to be east or west. And if you look at these geopolitical swing states, they want to be east. They want to be, you know, east when it's convenient, west when it's convenient, and then they want to be a third option for the rest of the global south looking to hedge.
And we've touched on the war in Ukraine a couple of times there. You were one of the first business leaders to go in and see Zelensky, and you've known Zelensky for a long time as well. What was that like?
So I had a very low opinion of Volodymyr Zelensky. I liked him as a comedian. As a peacetime president, I thought he had a hard time filling the seat. He fumbled the relationship with Trump. I did not think he was leading the country well. He was less corrupt than, you know, Poroshenko and Tymoshenko and the lot. So he sort of, but he was still, there was still a circle of corruption around him. But he wasn't running the country well. And look, I saw what everyone else saw, which is we all thought he was going to, you know, move to an apartment in London the day after the war started. And he stayed, right? And we don't see that kind of bravery anymore. Honestly, I think part of the reason Americans and Europeans reacted the way that we did is, you know, our democracies have been, you know, stuck with the sort of plague of social media, which has kind of unraveled them, the social fabric. And I think it made us nostalgic for like what the principles of democracy actually mean.
Yeah.
And we saw a real leader, and we haven't seen one of those in a while. And so, like, you know, I, from afar, like, you know, I really, I, it was hard not to, you know, develop a new view of him. And I had done, I actually had him, I'd been at Goldman Sachs for 2 weeks and we had our management committee offsite, and I had him zoom into the management committee, and we all got, I mean, it was really early in the war. So yeah. Now, like, everybody's on Zoom with him, but back then nobody was doing that. And it was like in the early, you know, weeks and our months. And we all got chills seeing, me included, seeing him on the screen, right? It was like he's fighting a war and he's zooming into our management committee, and he told us why. And so then I went to go see him, and I'd read in the history books, and I know enough history to know sometimes, you know, leaders make a context, and sometimes a context makes a leader. And certainly the greatest leaders in history have often emerged out of a crisis, but I'd never seen it firsthand. And I certainly had never had the before and after. And so, you know, when I went to go see him, it was 2 weeks after the Russians had started actually hitting Kyiv with these, you know, Iranian made drones. And so all the lights were off in the presidential palace. And so they took me around back. I went in, his assistant with a flashlight. I walk into his office, and I mean, I don't mean to sound like overly romantic about it, but yeah, actually, again, I know the guy, but it was like I was with a completely different person. I felt like I was like with Lech Walesa or Mandela or Charles de Gaulle, but yeah. Like in my lifetime. And I just had this like totally romantic moment. I don't even, yeah, I like barely remember what he said, because I was so mesmerized and enchanted by the sort of what I was experiencing, which I was bearing witness to a leader being made.
Yeah.
I was observing this at a time where my narrative had been that social media has accelerated the pace of movement making and slowed down leadership development. And it used to be you could be a great leader before you became a public figure. And social media has made it so you're a sort of flash in the pan social media celebrity, and maybe you can backfill it with the leadership skills, and that's a tougher sequence. And I think that's part of why we're being led in every corner of the democratic world by the leftovers. And our endowment of high quality leaders is drying up and not being replenished very fast, right? You know, it's all.
But dig into that more, because I'm fascinated by it. Because I actually think it's one of the biggest challenges for the West is persuading people, talented people, to go into public office and stand for it, etc. So I'd love to hear more about that.
Look, you know, Nelson Mandela, before anyone knew who Nelson Mandela was, he had decades to, outside of South Africa, he had decades to refine his leadership skills, refine his message. You know, learn what it means to lead. Same with Walesa, again, same with de Gaulle. You think about the great leaders in history. They weren't burdened by the 24/7 scrutiny. They weren't burdened by dis and misinformation. You know, the digital mob and the slander camp. It just, you know, they didn't have all that, right? But they all had their flaws, but they had the space to be flawed individuals pursuing a greater cause. Look at Thomas Jefferson, the first president I write about. In the book, we're all familiar with Jefferson's flaws: slave owner, you know, illegitimate child with one of his slaves. You know, wrote the famous line, you know, all men are created equal, except he didn't really mean it. Mm. But he didn't just not mean it for people of color and for women. He also didn't mean it for, you know, poor white men who didn't own significant amounts of land, right? And so he was this flawed individual. In an era of social media, we never would know. You know, Thomas Jefferson would not be the revered figure that he is today. I mean, he's barely still, you know, even hundreds of years later, you know, the social media is retroactively staining his record. So you think about all the great leaders in history and ask yourself the question, would they be ripe for the history books if social media had been around when they were alive? And I think that's the answer to your question.
This episode is powered by City AM, London commuters' favorite newspaper, covering all the latest political and business headlines. I think City AM is great. Whether you're just getting started in the workforce or leading in the boardroom, it delivers the news in a digestible way and has all the fun, lifestyle, opinion and sports segments to keep you busy on those long commutes. It was my morning read when I was in Downing Street, and it's amazing to now be featured in the paper. Download the City AM app or check out their socials and website.
And so how do we change that? Look, you care about this,
I
right?
I think this is a seemingly intractable problem, honestly. It may even be intractable. I think when we look back 100 years from now, one of the things that we will reflect on is how the creation of tools that were supposed to be the greatest export of democracy ended up, in fact, becoming an effective tool of surveillance and a tool that created such a signal-to-noise problem such a challenge for our social fabric that it made all the people we want to lead us opt out. It created sort of, seemingly insurmountable headwinds, to keep our democracies vibrant. I'm actually not one of these people who's decrying the death of democracy. I don't think that's the case. And I do think that we will sort of find our way through this, but it's a headwind. The founding fathers in the US, they anticipated a lot of things, right? It's amazing. They had no examples for the peaceful transfer of power. This is one of the things I observe in the book, which is kind of remarkable that, they achieved, they had no examples of the peaceful transfer of power. And, Alexander Hamilton had asked the question in the Federalist Papers, whether, of kind of what to do with ex-presidents, right? He asked, is it a good idea to have half a dozen men who had been elevated to the presidency kind of like wandering around us like discontented ghosts? And they left the matter unresolved. They didn't know what to do with ex-presidents. And we kind of winged it, and we never really codified it, except we eventually gave them a pension and the resources to build a library. But I think, and here we are in 2024, and you're going to have only the second rematch between two presidents in American history.
Yeah.
So we kind of have an answer to Hamilton's question of what to do with ex-presidents. Perhaps we run them again. Right. And so, look, I think that this, for the balance of my lifetime, I think this question of social media is going to persist. But there's another headwind that I'm observing coming out of the Middle East, which is we've all become very familiar with a post-truth, like, kind of political world, right? Like, we see things and it's just, we're in a post-truth world, right? We all understand that. If you look at this war in the Middle East, the social mediaification of this war means that you have more hours of footage uploaded to various platforms than you have minutes of the entire war itself. And what that's doing is, it means that, one, it's injecting identity politics into the Arab street and the Israeli street and American universities and the European street. But two, it's creating a reservoir of content taken out of context, manipulated, manipulated, misinformation, et cetera. And it makes me very nervous. I mean, I like to remind people that the 9/11 hijackers were radicalized by watching far less content with no algorithmic dimension of Muslims being killed in Bosnia in the 90s, right? And you look at the migration trends into Europe today. Backlog from COVID, right? That has been restarted. So, in a post-COVID environment, you should have more migration into Europe that had been frozen. Yeah. You had four coups in the Western Sahel in the last year and a half, which pushed migration into the Maghreb, which is pushing migration into Europe. You have more migration resulting from this war and all the displaced people. And you have sort of a number of countries going through elections that could yield populist governments, which have traditionally taken an anti-immigration posture. And now you have all this content ripe for radicalization, and it's very algorithmic.
Yeah.
It algorithmically tells you what to think, tells you what to watch, and it algorithmically shields you from the other side and offers you no middle option. It's a very dangerous recipe when you think about a threat of violent extremism. And, look, for me, the war in the Middle East on October 7th, this was the surprise that should not have been a surprise. It cannot be the case that we spent 20 years obsessively fighting a war on terror in Europe and the US, in every corner of the world. And then COVID happened. We went inside, reemerged to realize, no, the real threat is, tensions between the US and China. And so the terrorists said, oh, we're going to retire and give up. That's not how it works. Yeah. Right. And so I, when people would ask me what keeps me up at night, I said, this is going to rear its ugly head again. You couldn't predict that it was going to happen in the way that it did on October 7th, but I wasn't surprised
that it happened. Let's go back to the book. What was your favorite president to write about? What was one you enjoyed researching and writing most?
So I had a favorite and I had one that I learned the most from. My favorite was John Quincy Adams, because here's a man who his presidency was an intermission between two of the greatest acts in American history. The first one was architected for him by his famous parents, John and Abigail Adams. And it was an act that was sort of built on this idea of you're the next generation after the founding fathers, you're going to be president. And he basically just, he was Secretary of State. He was an ambassador to every, you know, major court. I mean, he was set up to be president, and he becomes president. And his presidency is like a political stillborn. It's a disaster. And so he loses his bid for re-election in 1828, and he's left with the balance of his life, and he doesn't know what to do, because it had all been architected for him top down from his parents to become president. And so he had achieved that, and that was his purpose in life. And then, like, he wasn't president anymore, but he was still alive. So he goes home to Massachusetts and, you know, he tries tree farming and all his trees die, and he writes about it as a metaphor for his life. He tries to write a biography on his father, John Adams, and he can't get through that. And so some of his fellow citizens convince him, you know, why don't you just, you know how to serve in government. Why don't you go, why don't you run for the House of Representatives? You know, this is a guy, he's already been president. He's been Secretary of State. He's already been in the Senate, the more important chamber. But he agrees to do it because the only thing he knows how to do is serve in government. Yeah. And so he submits himself to the lowest government position he's ever had. And as an ex-president, he enters the House of Representatives. But he doesn't know why he's there. He still doesn't have that sense of purpose. He goes on to be elected 9 times. And in that much lower station, he finds a much higher calling. And he takes a fringy radical abolitionist movement in the 1830s, and he mainstreams it and accelerates it by a decade. And he dies in 1848 in his 9th term in the House of Representatives at 80 years old, serving alongside a freshman congressman named Abraham Lincoln, and inadvertently passes the torch to a man who goes on to become the great emancipator and end slavery in the United States, you know, after the Civil War. And I love this story because he shows that a cause can find you. You don't have to find that cause. The reason he becomes an abolitionist is he doesn't know what to do in Congress. So in the 1830s, if you didn't know what to do, you would just read petitions from constituents. And some of those petitions were for the abolition of the slave trade and abolition of slavery. And as he reads these, which is just kind of a procedural thing, he sees the reaction from the slaveocracy and the slave owners in Congress. And he thinks to himself, you don't get to decide who can petition and who can't. This is embedded in our Constitution. And so he reads more of them. The more he reads, the more incensed the slave owners in Congress become. The more incensed they become, the louder and more colorful he is in his oratory around them. The louder and more colorful he is, the more petitions he gets inundated with. But he doesn't think of himself as an abolitionist because, again, it was a very fringy, radical movement. And it's only when they pass a gag order saying you're not allowed to talk about slavery in Congress that he fights that gag order that he realizes by the time he's, you know, fighting that and eventually gets it repealed, that in the process of all of this, he's taken the abolitionist movement from a context in the fight over the right to petition, and he's made it a standalone movement that is now as mainstream as they come. And I just love this story because, you know, when you achieve that great act that you don't think that you're going to top at whatever stage in life, people typically think of what's next of like, I've already been a CEO. Like, I've already, you know, worked at this great company. How can I possibly go to this lesser company? Or I've already been a CEO. How can I possibly go and be like a vice president at this company, right? You know, you think about all the sort of superficial ways that we compare and contrast the status of one act with the status of another act. What John Quincy Adams' lesson tells us is if you think you've already achieved your greatest status from a superficial perspective, don't try to top that. You know, go where you're comfortable. And see where it takes you. And it may take you to something more purposeful and more impactful than anything you did in that higher status job.
Yeah. No, and there's a great story about him skinny dipping as well, which I particularly enjoyed as well.
Right? So I start off, so I should say, by the way, each chapter of the seven, you know, so the book covers seven different presidents, and each chapter kind of represents a different model, right? And so the idea is that you as an individual, do you think of yourself as a serial founder? Do you think of yourself as someone who deferred a dream? Are you somebody who needs a recovery? Are you somebody who wants to completely move on? Are you somebody who wants to just dine out on what you did last for the rest of your life? You have a sense of who you are. And one of these presidents will speak to you more than others, or a couple others. But I start each chapter with a story. And the story that I start with John Quincy Adams is, you know, he's swimming in the Potomac River. And he sort of loses control, and his like heavy clothes get like weighted down, and he ends up almost drowning. And he's a month into his time as president, and he's treading water for a couple hours, and he gets rescued and brought to the bank of the river, and you know has to strip down. And so he and his valet, you know, get in a horse and buggy. They're completely naked, right? So imagine like a naked president and his valet. And John Quincy Adams is a strange, he was a very strange looking man. Like if I had to sort of, there's 45 men who've been president 46 times. And again, I'm counting, you know, the very heavy William Howard Taft. The one that I would least likely want to see naked is John Quincy Adams. it makes me uncomfortable to think about, right? And so Adams and his valet riding this horse and buggy naked back to the White House. He gets back, doesn't bother to put his clothes back on. And he just sort of confides to his diary that this whole experience of like being naked and cold and like riding back to the White House after having nearly died in the Potomac is like a metaphor for his life and his presidency.
It's a great story. The one that really spoke to me, I must say, that I hadn't been sort of anticipating was George W. Bush and how, you know, public opinion has changed of him and how he's essentially gone and done something completely different. Can you talk to us about the way that Bush, and you went and
and interviewed him as well.
Yeah, I spent 8 hours interviewing President Bush over 2 days. It's the longest interview anyone's done with him about his post-presidency. And I watched him paint for an hour. The reason people often ask, why did you choose George W. Bush? And I said, when I looked at the active living presidents, there was only one whose popularity had doubled. It was George W. Bush. Popularity has doubled since leaving office, and he's invested less in his legacy and less in shaping his image than any of his active contemporaries. You look at what Clinton, you know, has done, you look at what, you know, Obama's done, you look at what Trump, you look at what all these people have tried to do, their popularity has all sunk since leaving office. Bush's has doubled. And by the way, he left office, you know, historically unpopular. And so I wanted to understand how he did that. And, you know, look, part of it is he has this reverence for the George Washington principle of one president at a time. And so when I sat down with him, he said, look, you can't long for what you can't have. When it's over, and I don't miss it. And the next thing that I write in the book is, you know, I actually believe him. He's this incredibly disciplined human being, and he's a chapter guy. So he lives his life in chapters. So he had the politician chapter, and it was done. He, like, closed the last... His second term was the last chapter of that book. He closed it, and he basically put it on the shelf and never thought about it again. I mean, it's just like human. It's like a psychological thriller into the human brain. Like human beings don't function this way. So I really wanted to understand how he did it. And you know, he's so disciplined and so bought into this principle that when your time is done, it needs to really be done. And so he doesn't weigh in on politics. He never speaks out publicly. He doesn't hit the campaign trail. He doesn't speak at the conventions. He never mentions his successors by name. Yeah. And you know, other presidents say that they believe in one president at a time, but occasionally they'll insert themselves. Like Obama inserts himself every now and then. Clinton inserts himself every now and then. Bush never, he's never wavered from this. And I think Americans admire and respect that. And I think it's aged very well in the era of Trump, to be honest with you. Yeah. So I think he's benefited from that juxtaposition. But the other thing, and this is what, honestly, it's so obvious, but until he walked me through it, I never quite appreciated it. And it gets back to where we started, which is I was never one of these people who could enjoy the present, especially in my work. Just couldn't enjoy it. If I had a great job, if I had interesting days, was interacting with interesting people, some portion of my mind was on the next thing. And hearing George W. Bush talk about legacy, honestly, I think had a huge impact on me personally. because he starts off with, I hate the word legacy. It's a dirty word. It's a selfish word. And he's quarrelsome with it. It's not that he thinks legacy doesn't matter. It's not that he doesn't care about it. But he cannot, for the life of him, understand why somebody will sacrifice the present, sacrifice time with family, sacrifice time, you know, to think, sacrifice time to do things, to try to achieve something that they're not going to be around to see. He told me, he said, I read 3 books about George Washington last year. If they're still writing books about the other George, by the time they get around to me, I'm going to be like very dead. And it makes a lot of sense, right? And so he thinks it is such an absurd thing, right? You're alive now, right? Your family is here now, right? You know, your colleagues are here now. Like the impact that you can have, you can feel in this moment. And it's like, are you trying to build like King Tut's tomb, you know, for after you die? What's the point? And it's such a simple idea, but he says it so authentically and he's so principled about it and so disciplined about it. You come away from that and you think, you know what? That is a heck of a way to live life. And you know, I'm not naturally predisposed to be that way. So you know what I would do? I take my 1 hour bath every day and I exercise my obsession with what's next in the future and I get back to the present.
A couple of questions before we move to the lightning round. We'll try and make an evergreen podcast here, but I cannot not ask you about what will potentially happen in the US elections later this year. And I'd love to know, from your global perspective, just how Britain is viewed in the world at the moment. So
on the election, look, I would say it's a coin toss right now. It's different. You know, it's 50. I think it's 50-50, you know, with some margin of error that can be debated. So what can change the outcome of the election? Look, we can talk about inflation numbers all we want, CPI data all we want. At the end of the day, I think it's the psychological inflation factor 2 weeks before the election, right? So, you know, in the US, it's going to be gas prices and food prices. And even if the prices come way down, which they have been, it's a question of whether or not, you know, they come down below what people remember, right? It shot up so high, so fast, and it's come down now, but it hasn't come down below what people remember.
Yeah.
And so will that psychological inflation have an impact when people are asked the question, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? That's one. Second is this border issue. This border issue is a huge, huge problem, and it's a 50-state problem, maybe less so Alaska and Hawaii, but it's at least a 48-state problem. And it's a problem that's getting worse, not better, and the numbers don't look great for the incumbent. Look, there aren't really uncommitted voters in the U.S. right now. You know, everyone has an opinion, right? Yeah. And, you know, there are undecided numbers. I don't really buy them. And so everyone knows who they're going to vote for. It's who they would vote for. It's a question of who's going to turn out to vote. Right, you have, again, as I mentioned before, the only rematch between two presidents other than 1892. They're both less popular than they were 4 years ago, and they're the two oldest candidates in history, eclipsed only by themselves from 4 years ago. Right, so that doesn't exactly invite enthusiasm. The election will come down to a handful of districts in 6 states where the state will be won or lost by 10,000 votes, 20,000 votes, 100,000 votes, trivial. Third-party candidates will matter because of who they take votes away from.
Yes.
I think RFK Jr. probably takes more away from Trump. I think everyone else takes away from Biden for the most part. And it doesn't need to be a lot,
yeah,
right? You know, this is what people get confused about with the third party. It's not are they viable. It's do they 3,000 people deciding to vote for a third-party candidate may be the difference between somebody Trump winning Wisconsin or Biden winning Wisconsin,
yeah,
right? So that's going to matter. How the world sees this is very interesting. You know, I spend part of my job, you asked about President of Global Affairs, part of my job is to talk to presidents, prime ministers, foreign ministers, intelligence chiefs around the world on a pretty regular basis. I would say the world's thesis about the election is it's a coin toss. The prescription from that is because it's a coin toss, you have all these countries around the world re-engineering their foreign policy to hedge 50-50 for Biden re-election or Trump return. That creates a very interesting asymmetry because the Biden administration is not hedging for a 50-50 chance they lose the election. And so you're seeing over the next 9 months, you'll see a growing incompatibility with part of U.S. foreign policy and even the foreign policy of its, you know, closest allies. That friction matters. Three, the election's not, voters don't vote based on foreign policy, but this election will have a profound impact on foreign policy. You have tensions between the US and China, you have a war in Europe and a war in the Middle East. And with the exception of the countries that are destabilizing, none of the countries that can affirmatively play a role in creating off-ramps for any of this want to take a big risk or do anything significant without getting more information about what happens in November, because they've seen this dynamic of a new administration coming in and undoing everything that happened before. And if it's Trump, they don't want to get punished by him. And so with the US election, you have kind of a too soon, too far problem. It's too soon in the sense that, again, nobody wants to make decisions without getting that information. It's too far in the sense that the current status quo is a very geopolitically volatile status quo. And I'm not sure twiddling our thumbs for the next 9 months does anything other than create a very long runway of instability.
Yeah.
On the UK...
How has the US, though, ended up, for people that don't pay kind of that much attention to it as you and I do, how has America ended up with these two candidates again, the most unpopular generation?
Look, we're very polarized on are you a Democrat and are you a Republican, right? This isn't the first time America's been polarized, but we've been polarized on like really fundamental issues like slavery, right? On really fundamental issues, you know, like civil rights and social progress and wars and but if we're polarized on I'm a Democrat and you're a Republican, you can't really compromise that, right? And so it's this shallow pull. It started off as this shallow polarization that's turned into these hardened movements, and there's no room for dissent, which is why the House is sort of hijacked by like a blocking minority of like seven people or six people, right? It's how you have a situation where, Donald Trump can tweet something and, senators who, who believe something end up balking at it. But the same thing happens on the Democrat side, right? Look at the votes now. They're totally, they vote totally along partisan lines. You could say the grass is green. You could have a resolution to affirm the fact that that grass is green, and it would be a partisan vote. I think social media has been a real exacerbator in this, both in terms of disincentivizing people to run and making it really difficult. It's almost like too much transparency into the political deliberations. I'm actually a fan of some privacy. I don't want to see everything because I want stuff to get done. But the other thing I'd say on the election is there's a lot of focus from other leaders right now on who in the Trump administration rather than what. They recognize that the policies in the Trump administration will be a function of who he puts in different positions. So Robert Lighthizer is your window into trade. There's a general feeling that tensions between the US and China are pretty bipartisan and will sustain regardless of who wins. If it's Biden, it'll be more focused on export controls and technology. If Trump wins, it'll be focused more on tariffs and protectionism and trade.
Gotcha. Right. And the UK, of course, we've had a bit of a rocky time politically. We've had a bit of a rocky time politics-wise over the last 6 years. What's the world's view of the UK at the moment?
Look, I think it's not fair for me to be the pot calling the kettle black, but you've had a lot of prime ministers in a short period of time. The era of like a 10-year, premiership under Tony Blair is not the era that we see now. I actually think Rishi's doing a decent job given the hand he's been dealt, but the circumstances are such that you've got these kind of coalition governments in the UK and Europe that make it very difficult for leaders to come in with a mandate.
Yeah.
Right? And so, my favorite question when I meet with European prime ministers is what percentage of the vote do you need to win to be prime minister? It's rarely more than like 13%, right? And I think that's, how can you lead that way? Right. And, one of the things that the U.S. has going for it is a two-party system and this federalist system of state and that's helped protect us from these coalition from becoming a coalition government. We have our own problems. But I think what's also interesting is the role that the U.K. is playing on foreign policy. I think it's getting harder and harder for the U.K. to find a voice and a seat at the table bilaterally as a country.
Yeah.
And you're not in the EU. And the US used to rely on the UK to influence the EU and as sort of visibility into the direction of travel in the EU. And I think Brexit kind of abdicated that role. I think the IRA created some additional friction, and it showed you just kind of like, the haphazard nature of the relationship. So I think the UK now kind of has to assert itself almost through the G7, right? And you see that happening. I actually am I'm very happy they brought David Cameron back as foreign secretary. I think he's actually filling the seat really well. He brings some stature to British foreign policy that I think is really important right now. And I give, Rishi Sunak a lot of credit for doing that. I think it's not an easy decision to bring an ex-prime minister in. And if we think we have a hard time figuring out what to do with ex-presidents in the U.S., I think it's even harder to figure out what to do with ex-prime ministers. And I think David Cameron's answered that question really well.
Yeah.
And I think Rishi Sunak has facilitated that really well.
I think it says a lot for Sunak as well, because it would have been easy for him when things are very tough at home, poll ratings very low, etc. It's quite a relief actually he's going to do foreign affairs stuff, but actually he's really committed to the domestic agenda by bringing in somebody like, as you said, Kevin Stature to do the job. We've just got a few, as your friend Adam Grant calls it, lightning round. Yep. I was inspired by listening to you on his podcast. Who's the most underrated president? Not just from the book, but just Germany.
I mean, I think John Quincy Adams is the most underrated president. If you look at, and I think you have to look at presidents in their entirety, right? You have to look at their march to the presidency. You have to look at their time in office. And, for better or for worse, ex-presidents have status, and what they do with it is part of their life story, right? And their lives are a trilogy, right? The pre-presidency, the presidency, and the post-presidency. And what they do in volume 1, 2, and 3 matters. I think John Quincy Adams had one of the most extraordinary pre-presidencies and one of the most extraordinary post-presidencies, and I don't really care what his 4 years as president were like.
Yeah. If you could go back and listen to one presidential speech, which one would you choose?
Yeah, they didn't really give a lot of speeches early on. They wrote, right? But if you mean speech literally, I've always loved Theodore Roosevelt's In the Arena speech, because I think it it resonates today. It's hard to say anything early on because they spoke in such an incomprehensible old English way that I'm not sure I would have understood it without going to the back of the Shakespeare glossary.
It's very good. You are a collector of presidential memorabilia. What's your favorite piece of presidential memorabilia?
Well, I have 12 locks of presidential hair. I've basically embraced the hobby. I own it. I'm not embarrassed by it.
Yeah.
I talk about it a lot. I do a little bit of market making. But my favorite piece of presidential trivia or memorabilia, I have the vial of poison that James Garfield's assassin had sent to him by his sister while he was in prison after killing the president, because he had planned to take his own life before being hanged. I know that he didn't ingest the poison, one, because he was hanged, and two, the poison is in a vial in my library.
And what's your favorite? You obviously interview a lot of people. What's your favorite question to ask people?
I love asking people to give me an example of when they went off consensus.
Yeah.
And I like seeing how they answered it, right? Is it a decision they made? Is it an experience they had? Is it an opinion they have? I think it tells me a lot about people's unconventional side. I see resumes all the time. They all look the same to me. I'm always looking for somebody who's gone off consensus. And so I try to, ask that question, because you can what's always interesting is that when somebody is trying to tell you how they've gone off consensus in a very consensus way, it tells you probably don't want to hire them.
Looking at the next generation of potential US presidents, which US politicians should we have an eye on?
I think we've gotten a little obsessed with looking at candidate pipelines from Congress. Historically, that's not where candidates come from. So I would look at some of the young governors on the Democratic side, and on the Republican side. Also, you know, look at some of the women who are stars on both sides of the aisle. You know, it's crazy that we have not had a female president yet. I mean, it's ludicrous, and there's a lot of talent on both sides. I actually think on both sides of the aisle, there's some really great young people, you know, who I've gotten to know well. The question is, will they stick it out long enough, right? And this is what I don't know.
We have got a real problem with that in the UK as well, in terms of lots of people standing down. Partly because I think it's so intense and so on. What's more accurate, House of Cards or Silicon Valley?
Probably Silicon Valley. Less murder.
Yeah, exactly.
Less murdery.
If you were 24 in 2024, where do you think you'd be looking to start your career?
So this gets to the sort of like managing my life like a portfolio of curiosities. This is always the advice that I give people. You know, you never know when the next dot-com bubble is going to burst, the next economic recession is going to happen. The one thing that you can be certain of is when you wake up in the morning, what are you curious about?
Yeah.
Just double down on that. I mean, it's and see where that takes you. It builds a career governed by conviction and enthusiasm and curiosity and you know, intellectual authenticity that gives you the best chance of success. Trying to pick which sector and which job and which sector and which company and which sector, even if you guess right, if it's not what you're curious about and interested in, you'll wake up 10 years later still at that job and want to do some kind of a reset.
Yeah.
I've seen it a million times.
What do you think your final sort of trilogy will be?
I will continue to take 1 hour baths every day. For sure. No, I don't know. I mean, it's like I'm not meaning this in some performative way. I've stopped thinking about that with any like real conviction.
Yeah.
And I would say it initially it was a synthetic process. Like it took work to not think about it. I very naturally don't think about it. I will tell you the one thing is, and this is more a matter of luck. I have basically, you know, one of the things I learned from George W. Bush is eventually your knees give out, eventually your mind gives out, eventually your legs give out, and all you're left with is when you wake up in the morning, can you still learn something?
Yeah.
And he talks about painting, you know, where he sort of found a post-presidential voice that allows him to advocate, you know, causes he cares about with undermining his successors, but he also talks about how it's given him an endless living experience, learning experience. Because I love presidential history so much, and because when I'm, you know, 80 or 90 years old, there's only going to be more dead presidents than there are today, and history is vast, and there's tons to write about. I do have something that I can keep doing at the end of life, and I know exactly what that is. Whether that's what I'll double down or not, I don't know. But like, I am certain at the last chapter of my life, I'll still be writing history books.
Well. We look forward to consuming many more. We could have done an entire episode into the 7 chapters. It is amazing life after power. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Jared, thanks very much for coming on Jewish Jobs of the Future.
Great, thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's episode powered by CityAM. To read my article in their notebook column on what prime ministers do next, or to check out the main headlines, go to cityam.com or head to the CityAM app. Thank you and see you next week.